7. My name is Scott Lee, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Scott.
You came back. I'm always impressed. Good to see you. If we could, I like to open each session with a few moments of silence. Let's remember that we've invited God here, and maybe re-invite and make sure we're trying to stay open. Let's take a few moments of silence. Amen. Thank you. I'm going to, Bob and I make this up at the breaks, by the way. We do not have anything, and I mean that. We decided. I'm going to do just a couple of minutes here on a concept that he touched on that's so important. I read a non-conference approved book. I do that occasionally. It was written by a man who is a PhD psychologist, and he's also an ordained minister in one of the I call him the gentle Protestant face. He's a Presbyterian, Methodist, Baptist, somewhere along in there. I can't remember which. And he was the chaplain of an insane asylum. And he decided one day to ask the inmates of his insane asylum a single question. And he asked them, would you rather be right or would you rather be free? And overwhelmingly, the inmates in the insane asylum said, we would rather be right. Do you know that back when I was crazy, I would have rather been right also? And I am now convinced that those are opposites. Not right and wrong, but right and free are exact and perfect opposites. That when it's okay with me that I make a mistake, I'm free to be myself. And when it's okay, and the Al-Anon side of that, if I've got a string holding you in line, if you jump out, you pull me with you. It's when it becomes okay with me that you make a mistake is the other side of that. And I've also decided, and this is red flags, it's just my own observation very recently, I have discovered the source of all anger in me, and it comes from being right. I have never been angry when I wasn't also right. I have been right when I wasn't angry, but I've never been angry when I wasn't right. When I can step out of the judgment of that leads me to being right, I wind up never being angry. It's been an amazing process. Experiment with that with yourself and see if you can find it. And I think you may find a tremendous freedom I have.
One little resentment I want to tell you about, and I got permission to talk to them about this one. When I, probably 15, 17 years ago, I was taking a guy through the steps, and we get to the worst resentment that he had, and it was for his father. And he came from an alcoholic home, and it was a bad home. And his dad used to get drunk and have these drunken rages and beat him to the point where he ended up in the hospital on several occasions. And this poor little kid grew up under the specter of that terror and walked on eggshells his whole youth. And sometimes his father would quit drinking and that would even be worse because he'd be irritable and he'd yell and scream and get to your room and you're stupid and shut up. And he lived with that for years and it ate his lunch. We suspect his dad may have joined Alcoholics Anonymous on one or two occasions for a very brief period of time, because there was a couple times when his dad would stop drinking and have a different attitude temporarily. And he would say he was going to get him a bicycle. And he would promise to take him to Disneyland. But he never did any of those things because he went back to drinking again and the beatings would start again. And this was a resentment that had dominated this whole guy's life for decades. It affected his ability to work and be a team player, so he always had to have his own little businesses because he had this authority figure problem. It affected his relationship with women. He had been in therapy for, I think, 8 years trying to get free from it, and he could never get free from it. He did everything. He beat pillows. He did the Gestalt chair with his father. He did all that stuff, and he could never get free. And we're going through the fifth step, and we get a third of the way into the resentment section, and he starts talking about this resentment towards his father and all the stuff that was hurt, threatened, affected, injured, interfered with. His childhood was a mess. He never could have any friends. He had to create this fantasy life to tell people about at school about what it was like at home because he couldn't tell them what it was really like. And he had this big secret. Kids could never come over to his house because he never knew if the monster was going to be home. And it was a tough resentment. And we get to this part, this was our course. And it says in there, you must realize how the person who had harmed you was perhaps like you, spiritually sick. And on page 90, I think it's 91 or 92 in the 12 by 12, it reiterates this and a little fleshes it out, this principle, this was our course even a little more. And we're talking about this, and I said to him, I said, you must realize how you are like your dad, perhaps sick, how you could have been sick like that. And he flipped out, and he started yelling at me, and he said, I'm not like my dad. My dad was a monster, and all this venom started coming out of him. I thought he was going to hit me or something, and he was torqued. And I just sat there and realized that I guess he's not prepared to look at this from an entirely different angle. I mean, obviously. So I don't know what to do. I just back off. I'm not going to push the guy. That's not my job. So I just backed off. You can't make somebody see something they can't see. So he went, I said, just go on. And he went on with this other resentment. And what happened next, I believe, was through me, but not of me. I have a friend, Bob, in Minneapolis, who says, or in St. Paul, that says, I'm never the well, but sometimes I get to be the pipe. And what happened next, I believe, happened as a result of a prayer that I say before I listen to a fifth step, and I get quiet as I instruct the guy taking the fifth step to pray and invite God in. I invite him in and ask him to make me useful and to use me. And what came out of me next was beyond anything I'm capable of. And I said to him, I said, something's bothering me. Can we go back to something else? I want to go back to another resentment. And he says, oh, yeah, you want to talk more about my dad? And I said, no, not that one. I said, back in the beginning, when we first started the resentment thing, there was a relationship that you were angry at this woman because she'd dumped you. And you were in the pits of your alcoholism. And I said, there was a couple kids involved in that relationship, weren't there? And he said, yeah. I said, I was just wondering if any time in that relationship when you were drunk or stoned on drugs or hungover, if you might have ever done anything to hurt those kids. And he put his head down. And I don't know what he's doing. He raises his head up, and he's got, after about a minute, and he's got tears running down his face, and he says in this choked, God, the pain in his voice was unbelievable, this choked whisper as if out of some sort of abyss, he said, I'm just like my goddamn father. And I said, how did you feel about yourself when you hurt those kids? He said, I couldn't stay drunk enough. I said, do you think your dad's any different? And he got this faraway look, and he said, he thought about it for a minute, and he said, you know something, my dad has never been able to get sober. I haven't seen him in several years, but my sister sees him. And he lives in this little trailer, and she says he's the most miserable, depressed, neurotic man she's ever known. His liver is failing. He has pancreatitis. He physically cannot metabolize alcohol, and his body has forced him into a state of abstinence, and he's the most miserable person you'd ever meet. And I said to him, I said, do you think that you could be like that at all? And he said, maybe without AA, that would be a vision of my future. And we went through this part, and we disregarded his father entirely. And we had to look at what kind of a son had he been. Not in the light of the beatings and all the justification behind that, but just on its own. What kind of a son were you? And the truth is, he'd been a lousy son. He'd owed his father thousands and thousands of dollars and refused to pay him because look what he did. And used his father's bad behavior to justify cheating him out of that money. He gossiped about him. He went around to everyone in the family that would listen to him and demean his father until he turned 90% of the family against him until his father was old and alone in this trailer. And so what kind of a son were you? And in that light, it was horrible. He'd been a terrible son for a man who was sick just like he was sick. You see, when he did this was our course, he was able to begin forgiving. And it just means to give to the person the same consciousness you would want them to give to you. You're just giving to them what you would want them to give to you. Or as it says in the Lord's Prayer, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. You see, he wanted people to forgive and understand him for being a terrible father. But he didn't want to give to his father the same consideration he hoped others would have given to him. And he was able to go and make amends to his dad. He called me from outside the trailer park and he was scared. And I said, what are you afraid of? He said, the monster. He hadn't seen his dad in years. And I told him, I said, you're here with Right Action. You're doing the right thing. Take God with you. God's with you. You're going to be fine. Go see your dad. And he told me later, he said he knocked on the door and the monster didn't open the door. This scared, shaking, lonely, hopeless, neurotic old man opened the door. And he looked in his father's eyes and he saw himself. He saw himself. And he was able to make those amends to his father, and he was able to go visit his father on a regular basis and take care of his father, and he took care of his father periodically until his dad died. And he would tell you to this day, he lives down in a suburb of Dallas, and he will tell you to this day that one of the greatest things that Alcoholics Anonymous has ever given him, next to his sobriety, is he got his daddy back. No therapy could do that. No human power. There's something that happens when we say this combination of realizations and prayers that grace comes into our life and opens up something in our heart that we could not open and no human power could open. And he got free from that. And what a powerful, powerful thing this is. There's nothing like this anywhere in any therapy on the planet that would get a guy like me as free from the things that bound me as this has gotten me free and has gotten thousands and millions of people free. But it all starts with very simple, tiny, incremental surrenders of my opinions and my judgment, my need to be right. Can I approach it from... And you know, the only reason guys like me ever get to a point where we're even willing to think about coming to the table with any of this is alcohol has beaten us about half to death. It has humbled us. And without that humbling from the bag and the bottle, most of us could never approach any of this if it wasn't a matter of life or death. This will bring us up to the fear section. The bottom of page 67. And okay, now here I am. I'm over four years sober. I've just finished my resentment inventory. Did a very good job on it. I'm sitting at the kitchen table. I got this big legal pad. I wrote fears across the top of the page, and I'm sitting there. And I'm over 4 years sober, and I can't think of anything that I'm afraid of. Now, I knew when I first got sober, I was afraid of going to prison. Because I was facing 2 years. I was afraid of homelessness. I was afraid of there were people that wanted to kill me. A lot of stuff out of my past. But I'm not afraid of that stuff anymore. And I'm sitting there and I'm thinking to myself, as I usually do. I was thinking to myself, maybe I don't have any fears. Maybe AA works. And I went to this end of the month speaker meeting that our inner group puts on. And there was a guy from out of town speaking. Gave a great talk. And I'm talking to this old timer after the meeting. I said to him, I said, you know, I'm doing a... inventory and got to the fear section and I realized I don't have any fears. And he said, really? I said, yeah, I don't have any fears. He said, you don't have any fears? I said, no, I don't have any fears. He said, well, can I ask you some questions? Yeah, sure. He said, are you afraid of large, angry, barking dogs? Well, I mean, everybody's afraid of... We're not talking about everybody. We're talking about you. Are you afraid of large... Well, yes, okay. He said, are you afraid of rattlesnakes? Well, everybody's afraid... We're not talking about everybody. We're talking about you. Are you afraid of... Yes, I'm afraid. Are you afraid of black widow spiders? Yes, I'm afraid of black widow spiders. And then he gets a little more personal. He says, are you afraid of being embarrassed? Are you afraid of what people think of you? Are you afraid of women? Are you afraid of rejection? Are you afraid of homosexuality? Are you afraid of being broke? Are you afraid of being a success and then what people might expect of you? Are you afraid of being a failure? Are you afraid of growing old alone? Are you afraid that no one will ever really love you? Are you afraid that you can't really trust God? Are you afraid that you're going to get sick and not be able to take care of yourself? Are you afraid of cancer? I had cancer every fourth week in my early sobriety. Oh, man. And he went on and he said, are you afraid of stuff out of your past catching up with you? On and on and on. And then he finally says, so is there anything you're not afraid of? And I thought, how did he do that? I'm sitting at that kitchen table looking for fear. I'm like a fish looking for water. The book says it's an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. It is the force that drives me to think, judge, walk, act, work, carry myself, associate with everything I do. It's the driver behind it. You know that edge that's in me? What's behind the edge? It's the fear. It's what's pushing me. It's what's driving me. It's why I drive the car I drive. It's why I work the way and carry myself at work the way I carry myself. I'm afraid of what you'll think of me. It's the reason I share what I share in meetings. It's the driving force behind my life. And I don't even know it. And I realized that I was afraid of being afraid. That one of my old ideas that I must have formed when I was a little kid was that if you're afraid, there's something wrong with you. If you're afraid, you're less than a man. If you're afraid, you're weak. If you're afraid, you're vulnerable and people will take advantage of you. And the simple truth is, if you're afraid, you're just afraid. It don't mean nothing except that you're afraid. And it's the fears that are unrealized that seem to have done me more harm because they have the most power over me. Spiritual sickness grows the strongest in the dark. And so we bring these things out into the light of day. And the book goes on to say that these fears, the bottom of 67, the third line up, it says they set in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve, but did not we ourselves set the ball rolling. What does that mean? Well, I'll tell you what I found out. One of the reasons I can't manage my own life is in the act of managing it, I try to protect myself from the things I'm afraid of, the things I'm afraid of losing or the things I'm afraid of not getting. And in the process of doing that, I set in motion situations that really most of the time make the fears come true. Psychiatrists call it self-fulfilling prophecies. And I'll give you a couple examples. First relationship I ever get in sobriety, I don't have much to bring to the table. I mean, I would have told you I have some self-esteem, but I really didn't. Not yet. I was only sober a little over a year. I mean, I haven't made my amends yet. I haven't done a lot of service. I haven't rubbed away any of the damage I've done to myself. I have done nothing really except gone to some meetings and do a little bit of service in AA. I haven't changed the way I felt about myself. So secretly, I'm coming from behind in this relationship. I got this fear. What's the fear? The fear is that she's going to dump me. So what happens? The fear drives me to being the possessive, controlling, smothering person that drives her out of my life. I became the guy who is always looking at her in meetings. If she hugs some guy, I'm going, hey. And I pull the guy aside after the meeting, don't you be hugging my girlfriend, you know, right? I'm like a nutcase, right? She said to me once, she says, you're always looking at me. I said, yeah, I'm checking out my territory, right? Drove by her apartment in the middle of the night, make sure no guy's cars are there, you know, I'm crazy. And what happened? I literally smothered her and drove her out of my life. I remember the day she left. I was devastated because I put my validation, my security, my value, everything into this, my emotional security, all into this relationship, and it was gone. It was like there was a hole bigger than I am, right in the middle of who I am. And in the middle of the desolation, and the extreme anguish and pain was a little voice in my head that said, see, you were right. I like being right. Devastated, almost ready to drink, but I'm right. And isn't my fears just once again these judgments, these ideas that maybe they're new old ideas, but they're ideas just the same that really is the problem? You see, I didn't have to be afraid. There was only one person that was going to make her leave that relationship, and it was me. I didn't have to be afraid of anybody else. I was the guy. I had an opportunity when I was a kid in my early 20s, before I got sober. My dad, it was the last time my dad ever went to bat for me and tried to help me. And he had a friend who had started this environmental engineering outfit. And this was cutting edge stuff. Water pollution, air pollution for industry was a big deal in the United States back in those days. It still is, but it was a really big deal then. It was ground floor. And this guy gave me a job and an opportunity to become an environmental engineer. And he was going to handle my education, the whole deal. It was a wonderful opportunity for a guy who didn't have any education. And I went to work there, but I had a fear. And what's the fear? The fear is that I'm afraid that the other people I work with are not going to accept me. I'm afraid that behind my back, they're probably saying things like, well, you know that Bob. You know, the only reason he's working here is his dad is friends with the boss. Otherwise, we wouldn't have someone like him here. Now, I'm imagining all this. The book talks about fancied or real. So what happens? I'm afraid they're not going to accept me. So what happens? The fear drives me to being the defensive guy who's always on the muscle around those people. The kind of guy that's, what do you mean by that? The kind of guy that gets everybody walking on eggshells around him. Until one day they're calling me to the office and they're saying, Bob, you're a hard worker, but we're going to have to let you go because, Bob, you're not a team player. And I made the fear come true, and the little voice in my head said, see, you were right. I like being right. Unemployed, but almost homeless, but right. Right. The bottom of that page, the last word, it says sometimes, and then on the next page, we think fear ought to be classed with stealing. It seems to cause more harm. Nothing will rob you of abundance, of love, of opportunity, of richness, of friendships, of intimacy, and the vitality of life as much as fear. It causes paralysis. It is all through my life I have thrown away opportunities for incredible stuff because I was afraid I wouldn't enjoy it, or I was afraid I wouldn't measure up, or I was afraid of something. There's people in my life today, my sponsor is one of them. My sponsor, I kept him like this for my first 12 years, 13 years of sobriety. And I had a lot of judgments about him. And I didn't know anything about him. I don't need to know anything about someone to judge them properly. I mean, I really, it's never been a deterrent to me. I just make stories up in my head about people. And I had all these stories in my head about him. And why? And I kept him like this. And why? Because I was afraid that if I let him in, that he wouldn't like me. So I rejected him first. If you've ever seen, one of my favorite movies of all times is the movie Pay It Forward. If you've never seen it, I'll tell you, don't miss an opportunity to watch that movie. It's one of the greatest recovery, spiritual recovery movies ever made. And there's a scene in Pay It Forward where Kevin Spacey and Helen Hunt are standing in this parking lot. And they've been dancing around this almost a relationship, but not really a relationship for a while. And finally, Helen Hunt gets fed up and she says to Kevin, you're afraid that I'm going to reject you. And she says, I can't. You're too quick for me. And I always would reject you if I suspected, fancied, or real, just had any fear that you wouldn't like me or you're going to reject me, I'd beat you to it. And so I kept like this. And I never gave any of those people a chance. And some of those people now are in my life. And I wish they would have been there for years before they were. And what stole that and robbed that opportunity from me? Except my fear. I have things in my life I love to do. One of my favorite things to do is scuba dive. I fly all over the world scuba diving. I just love it. Another thing I love is motorcycles and skiing and all kinds of things. I had opportunities to do all that stuff, but I was afraid. So I was afraid of looking bad, or I was afraid of being stupid, or I was afraid of the learning curve. I'm willing to start anything at the top. But there's a learning curve with most things. And I'm afraid, and the fear robbed me of those opportunities. And when I grew enough spiritually to take some risks and trust God enough to try some stuff, I realized I loved those things. And it was only my fear. I sat with an old-timer who was dying of cancer years ago, a guy named Rusty, who helped me a lot when I was new. And Rusty said something to me that was very interesting. He said, kid, it's odd that when you get in the home stretch and you're getting near the end, and you look back over your life, he said, it's not the mistakes I've made that I regretted. It's the things I was too afraid to try and the people I was afraid to love and the opportunities I missed because I was too afraid. Nothing steals from us more than fear. And maybe that's, if I could get free of nothing else except resentment and self-centered fear, that would be a tremendous, tremendous thing for a guy like me. Tremendous. But what do we do about these fears? Well, it says we reviewed our fears thoroughly. We put them on paper. So once again, like resentments, I'm making a list. I asked myself this question, why had I had them? Why did I have these fears? Now, the book comes back and it answers the question. It answers it in a general way, but I asked the guys I sponsored, be more specific, because this is going to eventually tie into your eighth and ninth step. So it answers the question saying, wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? Well, that's true. Across the board, in every case, that's true. But specifically, why did you have the fear? Now, a big fear, last year I was over at one of the halfway houses. A guy that's sober a little while, he's working on his fourth step, and he comes up to me and he said, can I ask you a question? And I said, yeah. He says, I'm writing my fear inventory, and I don't understand why I have some of these fears. And I said, oh, well, can you give me an example? And he says, yeah, let me think. And he reaches in his pocket, he pulls out a cigarette, he lights it up, takes a hit off it, and he goes, I'm afraid of lung cancer. And I start laughing. I said, you don't know why you're afraid of lung cancer. He goes, no. I said, you're smoking. Of course you're afraid of lung cancer. That's like people, I'm afraid of the IRS. Why are you afraid of the tax people? Well, because you haven't paid your taxes. Of course you're afraid of them. I'm afraid of the police. Why? Because you have warrants out for your arrest. I'm afraid of the drug dealer. Why? You owe him $1,000. Oh, you're afraid of him, are you? Right? It's very important to look and see specifically why you're afraid to face these people, why some of these creditors, why some of these people that you've done things that you're ashamed of, why you're afraid to be around them, why you're afraid to face them. We ask ourselves why we had it, had them. Wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? Self-reliance was far as good as it went, but it didn't go far enough, and some of us once had great self-confidence, but it didn't fully solve the fear problem or any other, because we can't manage our own life. Of and of myself, I'm not enough. When it made us cocky, it was worse than it really was. Do you know that there's one of my favorite analogies of people who respond to fear will either respond to fear as a skunk or as a turtle. A skunk, when they're afraid, sprays everybody around them. A turtle pulls his head into the shell and waits for the fear to pass. I came here a skunk that's hoping to become a turtle. You know why? Turtles make less amends. Turtles make less amends. I would much rather be a turtle than a skunk. But the ultimate, that's not the ultimate answer. The ultimate answer is in the next paragraph. It says, perhaps there is a better way. We think so, for we are now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. Trusting God is the answer. Yeah, but what's that mean? I went to an old timer in my early sobriety, and I was full of anxiety. And I was sober enough to start to identify worry as a type of fear. And anxiety is a type of fear. And I said to this guy, I said, I don't know what's wrong with me. I said, I get up in the morning, I get down on my knees, I turn my will and my life over to the care of God. I say that third step prayer. And 20 minutes later, I'm back in my head running the universe. And I'm afraid and anxious. I'm in my head thinking about when I get to work, my boss will probably say this, and then I'll say that, and then he'll say this, and then I'll say that. And I'm just spinning all day long with stuff like that. And he said to me, he said, you pray? I said, yeah, every day. Do you have faith in God? I said, yeah. I said, I know I'm sober longer than I've ever been my whole life since I first drank, and I know God did that. He said, but do you trust him? And I must have looked at him like, I'm not sure what you mean. And he says to me, let me tell you the difference between faith and trust. He said, you can have all the faith in the world and pray fervently every day and still die of alcoholism. And I'm telling you, I've seen that. I've seen some very religious people die, drink themselves to death. He said, for people like us, it's faith is not enough. We have to have trust. And he said, here's the difference. If you went to a circus and you sat in the audience and you watched a tight wire act and you watched a guy come out to the edge of the wire on the platform pushing a wheelbarrow, you could sit in the audience and have all the faith in the world that he's a professional. He can walk across that tight wire pushing that wheelbarrow. You'd say to yourself, I bet she's done 1,000 times. I have absolute faith he can do it. But if you had trust, you'd go up and get in the wheelbarrow. And when he said that, I knew what he meant. I thought, oh, no. I know what he means. He means I have to actually conduct my life by letting it go as if God's really got it all. See, I don't really want to get in the wheelbarrow. I like talking about getting in the wheelbarrow. I like reading about getting in the wheelbarrow. I like going to discussion meetings and discussing getting in the wheelbarrow. I like going out to coffee with people and philosophizing about getting in the wheelbarrow. But I don't want to get in the wheelbarrow. I'm afraid.
Because I got this old idea that if I ever really absolutely surrendered 100% and got in that wheelbarrow, I'd get halfway out that wire and I'd hear this voice that goes, "Is that Bob? Is that guy that used to sneak looking at National Geographics when he was a kid? Is that Bob?" Right? Because I don't trust God. So what do you do if you're wired that way? What do you do if intellectually you can look at your life and you can get it that you've burnt it to the ground over and over again as a result of you being at the helm, and you need to get in the wheelbarrow, and you understand that, you don't argue with that, and yet emotionally you can't get in? What do you do? What happens? Page 53. This is exactly what's happened to me. Sometimes my whole life in sobriety has come down to this paragraph. It says, "When we became alcoholics, crushed by a self-imposed crisis I could not postpone or evade, I have been crushed by many self-imposed crises I could not postpone or evade in sobriety." Like it says in chapter 5, "Made decisions based on self, which later placed me in a position to be hurt. Crushed by self-imposed crisis I could not postpone or evade, I had to fearlessly face the proposition that God is either everything or else he is nothing. God either is or he isn't. And my whole life hangs on a choice. What's my choice to be?" You see, I have found myself in sobriety in places where I am absolutely backed into a corner. I don't have a plan. I don't know how I'm going to stop what appears to be something that's awful from happening. I don't know how I can change it. I am terrified. I don't know what else to do. And I'm forced by an absolute lack of alternatives to turn to God and start to act like someone who's in the wheelbarrow. And I go to my sponsor and he tells me how to conduct myself as in the middle of my head spinning and I can't get anything from meditation because I'm nuts. And my sponsor gives me direction and I follow the direction. I act as if I was in the wheelbarrow even though I don't feel like it. And what has happened is I get through the situation and I come out the other side and I get it that I have been protected and I have been taken care of. I didn't deserve it because I made the decision based on self, which put me in that position. But I have been protected in spite of myself. And I start to trust something that I have a hard time trusting in. And I don't know if it's 5 times or 10 times of being forced into the wheelbarrow, where you start to get to a place where you see it coming and you just get in. Right? You just go, "All right, I'm going. All right, God, here I am." Right? But eventually it becomes a working part of the mind. Eventually it becomes through practice of these principles, something that becomes a way of life. And I think most of us that are sober a long time that have tried this diligently and are not perfectly, but we have tried this diligently, eventually you get to a place where you know something that you bet your life on. You know that the power behind you will always be greater than the obstacles before you. And you know why you know that? Because it's been true every single time the last 28 and a half years. See, God's never let me down yet. And the next time I get afraid, my head is going, "Oh, he's not going to help you this time. I mean, and I just, yeah, thanks for sharing," and I get in the wheelbarrow, right? You know what I mean? It is, yeah, thanks for sharing, get in the wheelbarrow. Scott?
Thanks. I'm Scott Lee. I'm alcoholic.
Hi, Scott. A
couple of pieces on this fear inventory. To me, the only part written is actually the fear. You can write some other stuff, but that's fairly simple. And Bob talked about this idea of trusting and relying upon God. We're not going to go there. We're going to be tight on time. But Roman numeral 16 talks about the idea of the necessity of belief in and dependence upon God. I got here believing there was a God and not having a higher power. That's pretty common. My host a couple of weeks ago at a conference said he believed only three kinds of people got to AA: atheists, agnostics, and the condemned. And I think that's right, because if you believe that there's a God, you'll probably get here condemned. And this process that we're in takes us out of that condemned thing. It's so absolutely necessary. It says we're in the world to play the role he assigns. Step one, section B, I'm not managing my life. I'm here to play the role he assigns. That's the bad news. The good news is I'm designed for it. As Ms. Linda says, God's will is a good deal. I like the analogy that God's rather like, it's like when God designed this particular animal, and he gave this animal a hunger and taste only for the leaves that grow at the top of a particular kind of tree. And he also gave the giraffe a long neck so he could get to it. I have a long neck for God's will for me. It's a good deal. Just to the extent that we do is we think he would have us and humbly rely on him. Does he enable us to match calamity with serenity? Looks like permission to make a mistake. Just as we do is we think he would have us. I don't always know what God wants me to do, but if I'm trying to do what I think he wants me to do next, I'm still making mistakes, but I'm making a finer quality of mistake than I ever made before. And we have a name for that. We call it progress. Progress is making a new and finer quality of mistake, or making the same old mistake a little less often. Because anything beyond that would be perfection, right? Yeah, so it's okay that I make mistakes because he's going to turn them into good things. And then the next paragraph tells me twice not to apologize for depending upon God. Tells me twice, must be important, and gives me a prayer. Let him demonstrate through me what he can do. And ask him to remove my fear. And it says that once we commence to outgrow fear, I guess if I can outgrow fear, fear must be a lack of growth, spiritual growth is my guess. I have a friend in Nashville, a lady was standing in line at a bank to cash a check, and all of a sudden there was a hairy arm around her throat and a pistol in her ear, and she was a hostage in a bank robbery. And she talked about it later, and she said all of her fears were in the future. That as she stood there moment by moment, she was physically uncomfortable and not free to go about her business, but she was really okay. She had a fear that he would abduct her or that he would shoot her. But moment by moment, she was okay. My fears are always in the future, always. And frequently when someone that I sponsor calls me with a question or a problem, I say, okay, I believe we have a problem here. I want to hear you state the problem again with the word today in the problem. And then let's explore answers that contain the word today. And let's get out of the business of fixing the rest of your life. It's just simply not our responsibility. This next paragraph talking about sex, I'm just going to summarize. And it says that we need to stay away from hysterical advice. And that on page 69, on about eight lines down, it says, we want to stay out of this controversy. We do not want to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. I had to go to my mentor with that one because I was badly confused. And he said, this is what he does with new men, and I now do it. Assuming the guy is single, I say, I'm going to ask you to leave the ladies alone until I can get you through these 12 steps. A couple of reasons. One is I want your time and energy on the step work. The second one is that as sick as you are, you have very little chance of attracting a healthy female. Now, you may currently have one fooled, but that will only last for so long, right? Healthy women typically run screaming from guys like you. And one of the side effects of getting... Somebody's had the experience. Hear that guy laughing back there? The run screaming thing's for real, isn't it? And anyway, and part of the experience of completing the steps is we're going to get you pretty healthy. One of the side effects will be you'll have the opportunity to maybe attract a healthy female. And then I tell him, you may ignore my advice in this category, and I'll continue to sponsor you, but don't bring me the problems you create for yourself in this category. I've already told you what I think you need to do. See, and that solves my problem. I don't have to continue to wrestle this sewage storm that he's going to invite into his life. And the truth is, I'll handle the first one with him and point it at it one more time. Say, we already talked about this, and usually one's enough for him. But then it asks the great question. It says we all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. And then here's the question. What can we do about them? That's what we're here for. We're not here to beat ourselves up. The question is, what can we do about them? It says we reviewed our own conduct over years past. Where had we been? Selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate. That list is all over this book. Whom had we hurt? Did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Where were we at fault? What should we have done instead? We get this all down on paper and looked at it. It doesn't tell us how to get this down on paper. And I think there are a lot of great ways to do it, and whichever one your sponsor picks is the best one for you, and I believe that. I'm used to column inventories, and so I have them use columns. If we take whom had we hurt for a first column, second column, dishonest, inconsiderate, selfish, third column, using jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness as tools. Those were my favorites. Mm-hmm. And then the fourth column, where were we at fault? What should we have done instead? I lay that out on two pages. It lays out pretty easily. My great mentor did it in sentence form. I say, I think there are a lot of great ways to do what's in this book with your sponsor. And I'm not near as hung up on format as I appear to be. It's content, I believe, that matters. But if we lay it out this way, it certainly makes step 8 really easy because you'll have most of it done. I'm going to bare my soul here in just a minute, and I want to take a look at page 124 first because I want you to know why I am doing this. I am not a grandstander right this second.
It's early.
Yeah, anyway, we're early, yeah. But you bought a ticket. Stay for the whole show. Henry Ford once made a wise remark to the effect that experience is the thing of supreme value in life. That is true only if one is willing to turn the past to good account. We grow by our willingness to face and rectify errors, convert them into assets. Alcoholics' past thus becomes the principal asset of the family and frequently the only one. This painful past may be of infinite value to other families still struggling with their problem. We think each family which has been relieved owes something to those who have not. And when the occasion requires, each member should be only too willing to bring former mistakes, no matter how grievous, out of their hiding places. Showing others who suffer how we were given help is the very thing which makes life seem worthwhile now. And that's why I'm going to do this, because there are people here who are going to die if they don't know this. My fourth column, this where were we at fault, what should we have done instead, only had three entries. And they were, I should have told her the truth, I should have left her alone, or I should have told him no. I had my last homosexual experience when I was 19 years old. I had been so beaten down by my father that I could not say no to anyone for any reason, for fear of for whatever that fear was, I don't know. I'm not a homosexual, I never enjoyed it. Do you notice that nothing, that I'm not changing as I tell you this? I could be telling you we went fishing yesterday. It's in the same category for me now. And I'm sharing it. A therapist friend of mine says that about 70% of heterosexual males have had a homosexual experience. I believe it's well over 90 based on the fifth steps that I've heard. Bob and I have talked about that. I think it's over 98. He says over 90. It's a big number. It's a big number. And it's frequently the one that the guy's taken to the grave. And interestingly enough, I've sponsored a couple of homosexual men, and some of the worst things they've done is had heterosexual relationships.
Yeah. That's so, right.
Truly, so I sit not in judgment on this. But what I'm saying is that I'm sharing this because if there's a guy in this room that's had one of those and it's the thing that's killing you, you can talk to me about it because I've talked to you about it, and I'm okay with it. And I'm not mad at any of those people. I've been through the forgiveness process as we outlined in the fourth step, and I'm clean on it. I share it only in the hope that someone can get free. I have this amazing gift. I become changed by this process, and I become two things. I become God's caddy. I still carry all the poison from my past, all that garbage, but it no longer has weight nor stench. And the reason, I think, is because I remain willing for him to use it as a tool to help other people. And I also become an apprenticed messenger. It says we tried to carry this message to alcohol. It doesn't say we carried it. It said we tried. I think that makes me an apprentice. And when I can be in here a caddy and an apprentice messenger, I do pretty good. When I become an expert on this thing, I get real sick, and you don't want to be anywhere around me. And that's part of what this whole thing is about. Bob said something the last time we did this workshop, was just a couple of weeks ago, that if you want to get, you want your past, if you want to get free of it, make it useful. And that's what I'm doing here. And I'm going to talk later on when we get to step 9 about some other things. And so continuing on this page, what are we trying to do here? It says, in this way, we're trying to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. So that's our purpose here, not to beat ourselves up. We subjected each relation to this test. Was it selfish or not? We asked God, oh my goodness, we're going to talk to God about sex.
Well, here's a news flash for you. He's the one that invented it. Nice job. Thank you very much. And I mean that. I don't mean to be sacrilegious, and I hope you don't take it that way. I mean, let's look at the truth here. We ask God to mold our ideals and help us to live up to them, remembering always our sex powers are God-given and therefore good, neither to be used lightly nor selfishly or disposed or loathed. And so what I ask him to do at this point, having done these things, is I want you to sit down and pray and talk to God about your sexual ideal. This does not have to do with what color her hair is or how tall she is. Not that kind of sexual ideal. Ideal in the sense of your conduct. And let's put the word today in it. What do you believe God wants you to do or not do, however you want to do it, in this category, given your current set of circumstances? Like, we don't need to know if you were single, for example. We don't need to know what it would be if you were married but temporarily separated but not legally separated, but you thought she had a boyfriend but you weren't sure. We don't need that one right now, okay, Charlie? Let's don't chase our tail. Let's get the word today in it. Given your current set of circumstances, what do you believe God wants you to do in this category? Mine is simple. I am married to a fabulous woman. She is supposed to get all of my sexual energy. Mine's pretty simple. I think for the guys I sponsor, if you write three or four lines on that, it's plenty. If you go past that, you did not understand the assignment. Get the word today into that. It becomes fairly simple. And then it says, whatever ideal turns out to be, we must be willing to grow toward it to make amends where we've done harm. Gee, that sounds like step eight. We found something similar to that two pages before, which I think we may have missed. We did so much on resentment. Page 67. Last paragraph begins with the word notice. Count up three lines above that. It says, we place them before us black and white. We admitted our wrongs honestly, and we're willing to set these matters straight. Steps four and eight have a lot in common, don't they? We just found two places where we're asked for the willingness to set these things right. Continuing at the bottom of page 69, we must be willing to make amends where we've done harm, provided we do not bring about still more harm in so doing. That's the overriding principle in step nine, is I can't hurt anybody. I can't make myself feel good by dumping the bucket on you. My wife doesn't need to hear my fifth step. In other words, we treat sex as we would any other problem. In meditation, we ask God, oh my goodness, we're talking to God about sex again. What we should do about each specific matter, and here's a promise, the right answer will come if we want it. God alone can judge our sex situation, but we're top of page 70, we avoid hysterical thinking or advice. I'm going to summarize this next paragraph, and generally it says if you continue to do sexual things in the sexual arena that harm people, you're going to get drunk, and that ain't maybe. And I think that gives me permission when I'm sponsoring someone who is doing that kind of thing to point at it and tell them very specifically that the book says you can't stay sober and keep doing that. I want you to know that you're betting your sobriety on whatever it is that you're doing there. And I think we better be doggone clear about it. It also says if you make a mistake and you're sorry and you're praying and really trying to do the right thing, you'll probably be okay. Next paragraph, page 70, to sum up about sex, we earnestly pray. We are praying again. Earnestly pray for the right ideal, for guidance in each questionable situation, for sanity and the strength to do the right thing. If sex is very troublesome, we throw ourselves the harder into helping others. Boy, that prescription is all over this book. I got a problem, I go help you. That's what it says for me to do right here. We think of their needs and work for them. This takes us out of ourselves. It quiets the imperious urge. That means overpowering urge, when to yield would mean heartache. This next paragraph is what pilots call a checklist. It says, if we've been thorough about our personal inventory, we've written a lot. If you have written everything that we noted in this four step that called for writing, and you've never done one this way before, probably you will have written a lot. We've listed and analyzed resentments. We covered that, didn't we? We've begun to comprehend their futility and their fatality. We killed us seven times on one page. I remember we did that. We have commenced to see their terrible destructiveness. We did that. We have begun to learn tolerance, patience, goodwill toward all men, even our enemies, for we look on them as sick people. We did that, didn't we? We have listed the people we have hurt by our own conduct, are willing to straighten out the past if we can. We covered that at the end of the resentment inventory and then the sexual misconduct inventory. I would propose to you, if you have done something else that was alleged to you was a four-step, and you can't answer that, yes, I did all of those things described in this paragraph, you might want to try this one.
This thing is absolutely life-changing. I got out of treatment in the summer of 1984, and they had given me a psychobabble series of pieces of paper that they alleged were a four-step. And I have to tell this slowly because I will lose my language if I don't, because I'll tell you what I really think about that piece of toilet paper. Anyway, and it was true, false, multiple choice, fill in the blanks. Do you still hate your mother was one of the questions. I mean, come on. I mean, just psychobabble. And the only thing that really did for me is it got me to step five, which is where I began to get relief. We're going to talk about that in the next session. But this four-step is powerful. And we talk about this thing digging poison out of our souls. That is precisely what it does. We dig out the anger. We dig out the hate. We begin to outgrow fear. We find a sexual ideal that works for us, and we prayerfully approach God with it. We truly begin to implement the third step decision. That's what this is about. Bottom of 70 in this book, you read it again and again. Faith did for us what we could not do for ourselves. We hope you are convinced now that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from Him. If you've already made a decision, all right, that's that third step decision we talked about, and an inventory of your grosser handicaps, we just covered that pretty thoroughly, you've made a good beginning. That being so, you have swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself. Well, I studied biology. I know what happens after swallow and digest. That stuff's out of here, right? And step four is about be rid of. It's about out of here. We're going to take a 13-minute and 20-second break. We're going to start on time.
Yeah.
Good stuff.
All right. There's just no way not to cut short on that.